Do I have to give my name or anything? Or?
I wonder, maybe we could leave the divers to the end. We could talk about Hong Kong, how that.
Right, yeah, right.
Okay. There's a pretty standard format for that.
Hey?
I'd like to maybe know a little bit about you, first of all.
Well, I was.
Maybe give your full name and tell me where you were born. And
oh, I was. My full name is Robert Dalzell, and I was born in Ireland, 1906. I came to this country in July 1930, and I landed in Toronto without a dime to my name. I went through all the depression. I rode boxcars under notice to the government. And I traveled as far, I stayed in Toronto up to 32, which I couldn't even make a dime.
Did you do any work at all?
Well, absolutely. I done any work I got was selling anything I could buy in the stores and selling it over again, or going around this people and buying and put a few dollars on the horses. We left Toronto in 32, 33, and on a boxcar, which we went to North Bay.
Was this you and a friend?
Friends, about 8 guys.
Yeah. Did you stick together?
Yeah, we stuck till we got to Winnipeg. But we, in the meantime, we had to get through North Bay, where a cop caught us in the yards and booted us out. And then we traveled to Cape Real, and we stayed overnight. We got a job there for 3 days on the road, which never paid us no money but rations. So we landed in Winnipeg in September, I think it would be 33, and after we got organized on Water Street, and we went over to on Ross, where they had just behind where I'm working right now, where they had the soup kitchen, the 2 meals a day. Well, we stayed in there, and then we were shipped to Hudson Bay. And
you were shipped to Hudson Bay?
Bay, $5 a month camps. And we stayed in them camps for 2 years, off and on. And finally I came out and done a little bit of harvesting. And a farmer and me never got on very good together. I didn't know much about stooking, or I didn't know much about horses.
Was this in Manitoba?
Yeah, in Saskatchewan. Yeah, and then I went to Shiloh for about 3 years as a head cookie, $5 a month, which we traveled in and out. So we finished up after the big march to Ottawa with the Regina and so forth. It's broke up all the relief camps, which we got a job with the CP at 2 bits an hour. That was 35. So we got for 3 months in Kenora and Kuwait on the tiles, but we didn't like the tile, the sweat work, so we booked off. We bought a tent from an Indian for $5, and we camped out for the rest of the summer. Then we came back, and I got into Winnipeg in 36. I got married. And my wife was already, she was a widow. and two children was nine, so we were had to go on relief. I worked in the wood yards.
Wood yards?
Yeah, they up in Allegan Avenue. I worked on street cleaning. I swept the streets in Belfast or in Winnipeg for 20 cents a day and paid for your meals. And we were on that. They paid us $6.75 for 2 weeks groceries, $14 a month for rent, and a ton of serious coal for 2 months or 1 month, and you know, the wood. And so I moved on to McGee Street into a terrace there, which wasn't bad. It was, and there were a whole bunch of us together on the same boat, which we used to have our little Friday night cheese and crackers and a little drink. So in 39, I was downtown on a Saturday night, and I heard about this Hitler and all this war business, and I went up. So I never had any inkling about army. So I knew a lot of the boys that run around with. So on the 12th of September, the day I actually joined up, I went to Minto Barracks, and I had a Scotch friend was staying. He had already joined the Camerons, and I went up to Minto just to see the Upward Squad or the boys coming out and parading. And I said to wife, and with a joke, I'm going to join the army, which she never really thought it was a joke, her being Scotch. And so I went up, and I had a daughter was born in March, that's Betty. And she was only a baby, 3 months old at the time. And so I landed up there about 8:39, and I was watching, and these two guards asked me, I was running up and down the little platform there, and they asked me what I was wanting. Was I wanting to join the army or what? I said, I would like to join the engineering, but outside of that, I'm not interested. And guy says, Harold, what height are you? I says, well, around 5'10". He says, you're a little short for the grenadiers, but I think we could squeeze you in, which I didn't recollect joining any army at the time. And he says to me, oh, yeah, are you married? I said, yes. He says, how many of a family? I says, three. And he says, well, he says, engineers only pay for two, and the grenadiers pay for three. And with that, I said, well, very good. And before I absolutely found myself between two guards, and I was in the
room.
No, not exactly. I was in the place where you join up, you know what I mean. In that group was 10 guys from Palmar. There was Buzz Windham, there was David Curry, there was Johnny, I would just forget his name. And these guys were all from Palmar, and I was the only Palmar, Manitoba, you see, right? And they were having, the Davis and Keenan was only around 5'10", Davis was not very tall, you see, and they're having a dispute over this little Billy, because he was an electrician. So this Buzz Windham says that if he doesn't join, none of his joins. And I guess he included me in the bunch because I didn't say a word, which I was all taken with a grain of salt. And so the guy says, we'll give him a test anyway. So we went through this test. And the guy says, how old are you and all this? And I says, so there was Sonny Veal was a medical sergeant. So we, from Minto Barracks, took his height. I was 5'10½". And about 127 or 128 pounds, and said, go up to the medical upstairs. So it was getting on to be around 11, and I went through the medical, and I figured, well, 127 pounds, these guys 160, I had a good chance I wouldn't get taken, you see. But to my mistake, this they always played, the Camerons always came up to Minto Barracks on picking up all the volunteers. So this medical doctor, he says to me, oh, he says, by the way, you're Irish. And I says, yeah. I says, I'm going to be. He says, you damn fools, you're still fighting over there, and you come back here to Canada and you want to join the army. I said, I didn't exactly say I wanted to join. I said, you got to pass me first. Which he took like a pretty, he said, oh, I see. And I said, you have to pass me first before I join the army. I said, that's your job. Well, he said, we'll see to that. In the meantime, he says, do you hear any noise in the distance? Well, I said, that's the Scots, that's papers. He says, your hearing is 100%, which I didn't believe at the time. Of course, to cut a story short, we had this interview, and we all went down, and they said they'll be back at 1:30 in the afternoon, which... So I went home and I had my dinner and my wife, and we were going up to a friend of hers at the Thelma Mansion of Ellis. So we took the baby carriage. So I says, in a joke, well, I guess I'll be in the army before I go. Well, she said, they won't take you. You have no worry about that. And I went up, and funny thing, it was around 1:30. Sergeant Hutchison, and in fact I met him in Calgary this year, and he remembers it pretty well. And oh, I get in there at about 10, and this poor guy, he had a gardener, about 160, so all he says is, Dalzell here, our Dalzell. He says, here, sir, he says, put up your right hand. I said, oh, put up my right hand. He says, swear from there on you're in the His Majesty's Army. So from there on, I had no choice. So in the meantime, yeah, oh yeah, this is the 12th of September, 39. Oh yeah.
Were there many other people joining the
Grand? Oh yeah, well, oh yes, you couldn't get around the joint, you know, that place was loaded. Well, there was anyway, whenever I came out that afternoon, I was more in a shock than in a dinner. Freddie Murray, a friend of mine, well, we went into the stores and I got all these putties and all this funny stuff. So this Frenchman, he was from Kenora, or he is a guide, and he says, you know, you can get, he says, I got 24 hours leave option to, well, I says, how can I get 24 hours? Well, he says, you ask Captain Hutchison, you're joining the army and you got to get your things fixed up. Which didn't amount to anything, of course. So I said, well, there no, we might as well try it. So I seen Captain Hook, which the company I belonged to then. And so he said, in the meantime, well, he said, I'll grant you 24 hours leave. So I didn't have to report back to Friday morning at 9 o'clock on the parade square, which I had friends at Davis and Shorts, who in the meantime I got used to the uniform and how to put it on and so forth. Well, I was in that up for about 2 weeks to 3 weeks, and we were doing rifle drill, volley in and out, and different things. So,
did you ever do any rifle practice?
Oh yeah, right. But in the old country, whenever I was a kid, I remember a guy always saying, if you're on a parade square, any volunteer, always put up your arm, even if to get it off for a few minutes. Of course, I figured, well, if it's anything worth, might as well try. So this Wednesday afternoon, which made a big difference to me as far as army life, I was on this parade and it was pretty hot. So the sergeant came up and he said, we want volunteers for corporals. For the armories. Well, I didn't know what he meant, the armories. Well, anyway, I stuck up my hand, which was only come. And so I said, well, we might as well shoot the works. And to catch up with you later, well, the kids only... So anyway, I had served 5 years in the old country as a fitter, and I worked in the shipyard, and I worked in the mills, and I had a good experience, I figured. So he comes along the line, and I'm in the center, and he says, well, I said, I served my own in the old country 5 years, and he says, maybe you're the man we're looking for. So I didn't pay no, he went straight on. So he says, Private Donaldson, two steps forward. And he says to Sergeant Major Caldwell and Captain Hook, says, take this man into Captain Morley and introduce him. He's going to be our corporal for our D Company. In the meantime, this was all disbanded after the Second World War started. It was an afterthought from the First World War that every regiment had their own corporal. That any rifles, anything got out of the store, he was in charge. He distributed them. So anyway,
that's what you did.
Actually, how I worked into this. So in the meantime, we had all defaulters and everything at the time. Defaulters, you know, guys right. jumping out and in, not showing up and so forth. So I went into the stores. So we had one from McNaughton was the sergeant major, and then there was this Nutby. This was this Joe Koloski that I had these books from, you see. And then there was a Neil, there was two or three guys. There was four of us. And we were in a unit in the stores. So what I done, all the different regiments coming in for rifles, I counted them. Say there was 20, 30, or 40 in one bunch. I checked them in, I checked them out. And then in the evening, if there was any, I used to volunteer to come back for maybe a couple of hours and look after the stores. And then I could always have a drink up in the sergeant's mess, which I wasn't supposed to. But anyway, and that carried on, and then I went down to the stores and I packed. I went through a technical store examination at Fort Osborne there, and I passed that. So that gave me the more that I was in the stores and technical storeman for buy as an armor. Well, I was holding. So that was the way the situation was till we landed in Jamaica. Now, Jamaica was a garrison troops, which didn't call for any technical storming, it didn't call for it. But we had a level, like Morley had a stores, like the quartermaster stores and the clothes, and we had a level place there for the rifles and stuff, ammunition.
Did you keep rifles and ammunition?
Oh, yeah, oh, yes.
Machine guns?
Right. Oh, yeah. So,
after all the equipment,
yeah.
For years,
pretty long. Yeah.
How about
uniforms?
And
no, it had nothing to do with uniforms.
Just the armor.
Yeah, just the armor stuff.
Would it include trucks?
No, nothing with trucks. No, no.
Just arms.
It's just arms.
And
yeah. So we were in this little place, and I used to clean all these light rifles and all. So Marley came in one morning, so we were getting trades pay then, you see. We were getting 25 cents. So Joe and me, that's not Fien, he wasn't so hot, he was from Bermuda. But he was in the stores at the same time. And Marley says, we have to disband. He says, you guys can't draw any trades pay while you're on this garrison job. So we says to him, forget about the, let us stay where we are. We're happy. Because the other guys was 24 hours on the internment camp on guard. See, they left in the morning, 10 o'clock every morning to 10 o'clock the next morning. So we had then, in Jamaica, we had the machine guns in the internment camp to look after.
What kind of machine guns
were they? Well, they were all set at different, for prisoners of war.
Yeah, can you remember what kind they were?
Oh, I couldn't.
Could it be Vickers?
Well, something after that. And then we had to go down to the guard room. And that's where all the ammunition and stuff was kept, and all the defaulters.
Can you tell me how, if I came in, say I was in, I'd be a private or something, and I was wanting, came to pick up some ammunition, how would I go about it?
You would have to sign for it.
I would sign for it. Would I have a letter from somebody?
Yeah, you would have to have a letter from your sergeant major.
Right.
You would have to have a letter from the guy that I would know, or I would never let anything out unless I had a signed chit for it,
right.
You see? And nobody got anything out of the store. Then we used to, all this old army, we had what you call the glass house there. There was one guy, Cool C Company, or Doodley, not sure what his name, but he spent most of his time in there. And that was, you went in on the double and you came out on the double. And they had only, all the old ammunition and everything that we had that went, we always took it down there and they had to polish it up that you could see through it. Different things like that. Of course, we...
Can you tell me how the ammunition was stored? Was it stored underground or above?
No. It was stored right in the... Jamaica was different from Japan altogether.
Yeah.
It was more or less a garrison, you know, what I mean. And We had colored people. We just had our ordinary store. We went in there at 8 o'clock in the morning. We stayed there for 3 or 4 hours. We finished at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we never worked much weekends. So we had a pretty good life there. Yeah.
Did you ever go any military training yourself? Like,
oh yeah. We went to what do you call that place now in Jamaica? We had a month up at Newcastle. And I went up with the, we had the Vickers, we had the Lewis guns, and we had, that's what we done. Each unit went up every month to Newcastle, and it was like 40 below up there. You know, the temperature would be 100 down in Jamaica with this. We had to use blankets. Then we went out to this, what do you call this, what's that song there they had? We had to camp out there every summer. To Little Bay or anyway, we used to go out there and we had a month out there. So our time was all for maneuvers and everything was always worked in together. So,
I've been told the Grenadiers were changed from a garrison force to an infantry force. Somebody mentioned. You were working in the stores then. Do you remember ever disbanding some of the equipment, like machine guns and that ammunition, and replacing it with rifles and that?
No, we actually had the 303,
yeah,
which standardized right through. We had the standard, we used to take these, what do you call these, 2-inch mortars, 3-inch mortars. So, well, we used to have sergeant majors there demonstrating. And then we had, the guys used to have a unit, and they used to have 6 guys or so. Of course, as you say, we were trained as a Vickers, but we had to change to infantry because the country was against us. The Vickers was no damn good where it you had. So then we got the brand guns. So,
these were shipped to Jamaica?
Yeah, well, yes, this equipment was all in there.
Yeah.
Well, then, after we came from Jamaica, I left Jamaica on September the 21st. I landed in Winnipeg the 23rd.
Now, did you have anything to do with the stores?
Yes.
Transferring them to Winnipeg?
Yes. We had to pack everything and put them in the boat and all the transportation looked after our own. The clothes and every, the headquarters, you see, all of us guys was, and I joined up in D Company, but I was transferred to headquarters. Now, every guy that was in different companies landed up in headquarters. So if I was in the stores at all, like Stinson and a few more guys was in different companies from me, we were all transferred into headquarters and we looked after. Those guys that looked after transportation just alone. Our job was just to look after our own little set. And then we had our QM, and we had our own little, so we only took orders from our own little platoon, you see? So we didn't interfere with anybody else.
How were the officers?
Very good, very good. Well, we had a bunch of officers like Bailey and They were officers from the First World War, not from the First, peacetime. And we got a lot of these young officers, lieutenants, and so forth, which is yelling. Of course, whenever you come into the Army, a man has been in the Army through peacetime, he's got a different opinion than a man that's just picked up off the street. You know what? You can't compare the both together. One wants everything done his way, sufficient under the, whether you like it or not. But we never had much contact, or I didn't have, with many officers, because I took my orders from the QM stores, which left me wide open to, of course, I had anything orders that went through them, I took for the granted.
Now, the stores came from Jamaica to Winnipeg by boat?
Oh, yeah.
Did you come with them, or did you come on?
Oh, yeah, we came, we didn't have, they were all shipped to Minto Barracks. Or Fort Osborne, whatever was. All we done was, pack them. See that they were put on the boat.
Okay, you came to Winnipeg and you had a boat.
Well, we had from the 21st, I landed in the 23rd, and we were out of Winnipeg on the 25th of October.
Did you do any duty when you were here?
No.
At Minto Armour's, go to the stores?
No, we were transferred to Albert Street. We didn't go to Minto. Where we were in Albert Street there, where the Scotch battalion was. You see, we had, what I would like to say, we had not rejects, but guys that was wanting to transfer to the Air Force, wanted to transfer to different places. So we were on leave. Well, I got so many days leave. And the first thing I knew, I was down at this Albert Street, Murray's, and I heard word that the Grenadiers was going to leave Winnipeg in 2 weeks' time. Where they were going, nobody knew. Just was, Sutcliffe was in charge, you see. When we joined up Kay, the QM, he came back from Jamaica. Sutcliffe was an old English captain who took everything by granted. Now, as far as I know, I'm not sure, but I heard he wanted this regiment in a hurry to go to Hong Kong. And Sutcliffe put in for it, volunteered for it. Whether it should have been the Montreal Grenadiers that went, but it happened to be because the Queen's Own Rifles went there. So everything was in a hurricane. We had guys coming and going, and you didn't know. Whenever I went down into this barracks, I didn't know one thing from the other, because I was checked in, and then we went down to the stores, and this was the biggest joke. We packed for 3 weeks all our ammunition, everything for Hong Kong or wherever we were going, where the result was that it didn't go till after we left Winnipeg.
Now, do you know why that was? Was it ready to go when you left?
Well, certainly it was ready, as far as I know.
But you weren't there when it was loaded?
Well, we helped. We helped. That was all through the Army. We give the orders, not was through the transportation, was to get it there.
Oh, I see, but it was ready to go.
It was supposed to be ready to go, but it never got.
Can you remember what you packed? Was it ammunition?
Well, I didn't pack anything to my knowledge, because at that time I was on leave, and I hadn't seen my family for over a year and a half. I think this was left to the army themselves, the outside of our outfit.
Well, where
was the ammunition stored? Was it Minto? Well, either was it Minto or was at Fort Osborne. But they had, now I can't place, but they had a, where it was now, but they had a place where all of this stuff the army had, it was all stocked there, and it was all shipped out of this one spot. Now I just, right away, I just can't place where it was, where what spot it was in, whether in Fort Osborne. But anyway, up till we left, till I left on the 25th, I remember it was Saturday morning, and I got in there at 9 or 10 o'clock at night. I had to sleep there, me and this Davis. And we walked from Albert Street to the station at 11 o'clock or 10 o'clock. Now, we got on the train at the CP. We marched down from Albert Street right down to the CP. That was down Princess. So we got on the train. We're all the designated to our different companies. So I'm not mentioning the guy's name, but I was standing the wives and everybody, so we all get off the train, kiss our wives goodbye and so forth. So this guy, he gets off and he's got nothing on him, all his material, his rifle, his things sitting on the train. The whistle blows, goodbye boys, we'll see you. It was it. Yeah. So the time we got over, we lost 18 of them.
Between Vancouver.
From Vancouver.
Well, did you know where you were going?
No, well, we had an idea.
Yeah.
Some of them had got in Jamaica, they drank and so forth, and you know what I mean. So, anyway, this was, I didn't know nothing about it. It was four or five guys.
How did you feel about going?
Oh, I didn't mind it. Once I was in there, I just took it for granted.
Yeah.
Oh, I never had one feeling all the time I was there. And I never regret nothing. But the funny part, we got into Vancouver was on a Monday, around 4. I think it was around 4. And we had a little march through up there in Banff for a couple of hours, stretch your legs. And funny part was, there was an awful commotion on the boat about 6 o'clock that night. And it says, a man overboard. What? So when it, finally the smoke flare, this guy, I can't remember his name now, but he was next to me there. I know very close. He had his wife in Vancouver, and he wanted personally to see her. I don't think he had one idea beating it, but he wanted to meet his wife, and he asked permission, and they wouldn't let him off. So he went over the ship, know the ropes, and he went right down into the yards. By the time he got in the yards, he was gone. So they moved the boat right out into the middle of the Vancouver Harbor. So there was an awful dispute over that. But we got into these hammocks. Well, I had 2 hours in one, and that was enough for me. I slept on the floor. This was an Australian ship. And they had this, what you call this, meal, you know, lamb, or what do you call it? Mutton. Good, that's right, mutton. So everybody, we're going to have mutton tonight. Yeah. So anyway, this wasn't a bad boat, but we had these, this Australian beer or whiskey, or beer I should say, and it looked like syrup to me, and these cans that we eat out of, you know, they used to, for the privates, they pour that into this can, you drink it, was like liquor, you know. So I had one dose of that, so I found myself, you see, the sergeant's mess was right up. So we lay right outside the sergeant's mess there. So we got the odd bottle of beer from the sergeants going in and out of the... and then there was a roll of dice.
The sergeants and the officers had different
beers. Oh, sure. Oh, yes, absolutely. You're not supposed to go into a sergeant's mess if you're a private, but... unless you're on duty or something. But and then the officers are all themselves. But, that boat was one awful...
Did you do any work in the boat?
Yes, right. Oh, yeah.
You're right.
I had the rifles, and you couldn't... I had got kids there never seen a rifle in their life before. We got all these... reinforcements, and we picked up 30 or 40 going through Saskatchewan. Some of them guys never even seen a rifle, never even had any basic training, didn't know nothing whatsoever. So anyway, I'm coming over in the Atlantic. I had my sea legs, which a lot of them didn't have, which was a good, the Pacific was like riding on the princess, you know. But, no, I had my little store there, and I had my rifles, and we had our drills every afternoon, morning, so many guys, and so they turned the guns and all in. So we were 19 days on that boat.
In this door that you had on the boat, did you have enough equipment for everybody on the boat?
No, not exactly, because the equipment was all in the hole. This was only rifle drill. Mm-hmm. You see, a soldier, doesn't matter where he goes, his rifle's with him.
Yeah.
We were only drilling with rifles. All the ammunition, everything was in the hole. Everything, transportation, everything's loaded right into the hold. Everything in the hold.
Oh, so you were just in charge of the rifle?
Yeah. Well, that was nothing. That was only... I just handed them out and seen that the guys got a little extra drills. But it took us 19 days on that boat, you know. We went through, and then we stopped at the Iwins, and we seen all them girls, beautiful girls with these grass skirts and playing the old pajama, you know. So it was really nice. And then we got
19 days.
Yeah, and then we got into Manila, and we got into Hong Kong. I think it was either on a Friday or a Saturday. It was a kind of a miserable day, November 16th, I remember. So we had to walk that 3 miles from the boat. Kowloon is on the mainland. Now we're getting down to the mainland of China. And a lot of people has an awful idea about whenever you land there, it's a bigger difference than what you ever expect. You see, you get off there in the boat and you're right on the mainland. Well, you have the ferry there. It takes you to Hong Kong. Hong Kong's a lot different from the mainland. So you get on the mainland and it's 3 miles straight up. Now they have these rickshaws and all this stuff.
3 miles straight up from where the boat docks.
You're right. Yeah, it's exactly 3 miles. So I'll tell you my little experience for the time we were in there for about from the 25th to the 8th was we had this big, you wouldn't call it a hotel, but it was the name where the boys used to go in English, and they had a big music and stuff. So the British and the Canadians and the English, they all didn't agree much. So they used to have their little fights in there.
Like a brothel or something?
Yeah, more or less. I was only in the place twice. I didn't get in very much into the place. But it was more or less like the women had to be brought in by a friend. The women couldn't go in unless there were escorts.
Oh, okay.
So somebody would have to bring them into the place with the arms, or they couldn't get in. After a while it became but when we finally got in there, so before the war actually started, we had all these different guys coming and going. Like we had the Indians was in a different regiment, and we had this Royal Rifles. And we had these English Royal Scots.
How did you get along with the other people?
Good. Oh, yeah.
Did you think there was any ill feeling between
you? Oh,
no.
How
about with the Chinese? Do you think you were...
Well, that's the point.
When you got off the boat, what did you expect from the Chinese? Were you well?
Oh, yeah, but it was a different story. There were a different story after the war and what it was before. Chinese are like this: as long as they have their rights and their freedom, you're the best. But once it's turned the other way, you're the enemy. You've had it. They don't want nothing to do with you. You know, it's just like the turning green from red. That's the way they work. They don't work for. They work for whoever's going to feed them first. So. I was getting to the point of Siam Sha Po when things did explode on the 8th. There was a lot of guys was up.
Before you go on, I'd like to know something about the stores in the camp. Is that where the stores were held?
Oh, yeah. Well, the stores, it was a funny thing. You can get all kinds of beer or stuff like that, or drinks, but when the war started, we were taken by surprise.
Yeah. I was just wondering, because I've heard that you mentioned a lot of the equipment didn't get there. I was wondering... But when the war started, what equipment did you have? Was there enough equipment to go around?
No. Oh, no, absolutely.
Did you have charge of all the guns?
No. You see, I was only what you call a technical storeman. Mm-hmm. So outside of that, you bring up a point. We never seen any of that stuff. That stuff was shipped on another boat. But that boat never even got to Hong Kong. It went to Australia or somewhere else. So we didn't have no transportation. We didn't have hardly any. We only had our mortars and what the heck, a few brand guns, a few this, a few that.
This is what was brought on the ship.
Right.
You trained with, eh?
Right.
On the ship coming.
Yeah,
over.
Okay. That's all we had.
Okay, were there enough rifles to go around? Do you happen to remember how many rifles
there
would be?
Well, there's supposed to be, in a regiment, supposed to be 865 men, say 850. And then you have maybe 40 officers or 40, so a crew would be 950 or 980. That's a whole battalion. So you got to have a rifle for every man. And it doesn't matter who, that man has to sign for his rifle. And he's got a number, he's got a serial number. So nobody can steal his rifle. Or he has to account for it. It's just like you go, you wouldn't walk out without taking one leg with you.
So there were enough rifles to go around?
Oh, yes, yes, right.
Every man had a
rifles didn't. We had, what we had was a brand gun. That's what I'm coming to. Is that when actually I was taken by surprise. This was on a, I was in camp. Now, this was on a Saturday morning. Or a Monday morning or a Sunday, I'm not sure now. Pearl Harbor got hit hard. And I woke up, I think it was a Sunday or Monday morning, that would be Japanese time. And I got rolled out of bed about 7:45 or 7:30, time enough to get to the cafeteria to have something to eat. I did. So they says, here's the Japs coming. Here was war. So we thought it was a joke, you know, at first. But the officer, we run out of the kitchens, you see, which here, and the Japs' planes was coming over. And they were bombing, you see, around the camp. Places. And the guy says, that's real live ammunition, you see. So we all ducked, and there wasn't a big bunch. There was a lot of guys was in these, locked up in the internment camp, or in the, you know, so that the old place was gone rifty rot. So they let all the guys out that was in detention and so forth.
These Canadians?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This
they were,
is.
They were in internment. Do you remember what?
No, they were, well, guys, default. Yeah, yeah, locked up for the night, you know.
Would it be quite a few
of them? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, of course, you see, some of them was getting out and they weren't coming back in again. So once they got them in there, they kept them in. So, well, we got hit all that day. Up to, and I lay over here and lay over there. And finally we had this sergeant, I forget his name, but he was in charge of the camp. Well, half of them was just drinking whatever they could get or, you know. Well, anyway, that night, 9:00, we got the last ferry out of there. You see, they were getting all out of Kowloon.
Yeah.
Kowloon.
Did you take any stores or ammunition?
We just took what we could. Some of us just took our own stuff. Because, you see, the boys that were training in Hong Kong, and they was all, mostly them was in Hong Kong. And they were, and the Royal Rifles and all. See, there was only 17 miles between the Japs and us from Kowloon. So it didn't take much for the Japs to overrun us. You see? It was 17 miles. And did, I was.
Did you do any work in the 3 weeks that you were there? Did you? Was it training or were you in stores?
Well, I had a look after. I'll tell you what I done. I had McNaughton was my boss, and the quartermaster there, he was in charge, and Morley. Morley wasn't there. So what we done, it looked every man for himself. So, and I had Jimmy Gard and this other guy, and we were in here, and that night we got over to Hong Kong. It was after 10, so we lay.
What kind of equipment did you take with you?
I just took my own rifle and my own ammunition. I just took what I had on my own.
Was there much ammunition left behind?
No. See, we had, whenever we went into, you know, all these big garages and everything, the army took over that.
This is in
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Now, I'll tell you, I had all that stuff in these big garages, and all these big hotels, or any place where there was equipment. I was in there every morning, sorting all of that stuff out, and getting it ready for the boys at night. Now, what was the whole big joke was that the stuff was so scattered around that it was hard to get to the right thing at the right time.
Yeah. I've got a map here. I don't know. I wonder if you can maybe remember the sun.
Well, where's my glasses?
And you're
still here. Yeah. Golly, man, yeah. There's Repulse Bay.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, I know.
There's one near Shaw Gap.
Well, I didn't.
Mount Nicholson.
There's Happy Valley.
That's right, yeah.
Happy Valley. Now I'll tell you about this. This is Victoria, yeah. Now here's this Wamsha and this hell here, Happy Valley. Now I can tell you all about this place here. Now, on the night after we got into, here's Aberdeen Harbor. Now, well, where's the, Kowloon. Where's Kowloon?
It would be here.
Here's
Hong Kong. There's Kowloon.
Yeah.
And the camp would be in here somewhere.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, you see, whenever we were in Kowloon, we came over in here. Now, follow this.
The alleys right there.
Right. Yeah. So, I was stuck in one of these. We made a headquarters. It was a house.
Mm-hmm.
Where we made coffee. We made everything for the boys. You know what I mean?
You like stew and things?
Yeah, right. Well, we had our own cooks. But this place, now, on the night, after we got out of Hong Kong, Kowloon, and got over here, I was stationed it was a school for these kids, you know,
mm-hmm.
And we had to protect the school, which was deserted.
Right.
And of course, this Joe and me worked together. What we done at night, we got all the ammunition. Like, say they wanted 10 machine guns, or 10 mortars, or this here up in this Happy Valley. When we had a driver who took us, so we delivered all this stuff, And our watchword, our password was Charlie. You see? Mm-hmm. So, that nobody could... Now, the Indians was in charge of this front here, which these pillow boxes was a down disgrace. They weren't even pillow boxes. A shell or anything or a rifle could go right through them. They were supposed to be cement, and they were just like lead. You know what I mean? They were, they were nothing. So that we had the Indians' troops right across here, right in Hong Kong on the main thoroughfare. They were guard on this trip. We had the volunteers here. We'd spit up a bit of a fight, but which is, but the big night was the 19th of December. Mm-hmm. That was the night.
What did you do before then? You checked stores every day.
Yeah.
Do you remember where some of the stores would be? Did you drive around the whole island?
No. We kept mostly to our own quarters. Yeah. You see this Happy Valley there, and right around Wan Cha Chat. You see here.
Yeah.
Now, you see. The way we had an English regiment here.
At Victoria Peak, yeah.
We had an English regiment, and we had, now to just to get you straight, the English looked after their own regiment, you see. The Scots looked after their regiment. Now, we were placed in one bunch, us. Yeah. So, saying this was the Winnipeg Grenadiers was right in this spot here. And then the volunteers would be here, and the Indians would be over here, and so forth and so on. Well, on the 19th is really the night that Japs really landed on Hong Kong. Now, our water supply was all cut to hell.
On the 19th or before the 19th?
Pretty well... We were starting to get the Japs had no planes whatsoever. We only had three which disappeared, and the Japs had all the planes, which was sideswiping. Now, I used to go in here to these garages on a Sunday morning when I would bring out all as much stuff, and the planes would be going diving right over. Well, if they ever happened to spot this place where I was working in, well, it would have been goodbye, you know. Because we had all our ammunition and everything there.
What kind of work were you doing?
Well, I was trying to get the supply up to the line of demarcation.
I see,
I was only supplying my own men. I was only looking after the Grenadiers.
Now, what campaigns would this be? Would this be ammunition? Would it be
right. No food, just ammunition. You see, we had mortars there and brand guns. Now, I'll tell you something. The brand gun, you're supposed to change the barrel every 50 rounds. Now, between you and me, I seen, I asked this young guy, he came along, he says, I give him a brand, I give him to change it. He came back about 2 hours later. He had fired over 200 rounds on the one barrel. The thing was so damn hot. When you took it out, it was like a jigsaw puzzle. It was so hot. And the barrel was absolutely useless. Well, the gun, now, you could still fire it, but what could you do?
Yeah.
I give him another one, a Lewis gun. He gave another one, a Bryan gun. And they couldn't even know the first thing, how to load it, how to put it apart, hard to take it apart. So I said, I have no time to show you. This is war. You can't fool around anymore. Your them days are over. Now,
when you supplied a run gun, would you supply it with one or two other barrels?
You have two to every gun.
Two to every gun.
Right. Because the simple reason you'll have to, every 50 rounds you're supposed to change it.
Now, how many shots would there be in a round? Would you remember?
50.
50 shots in one round?
Like, well, you can go 50 repeat. It's just like a revolver or anything. You load it if you have six things in it. You know what I mean.
Yeah. Now, is there a clip or does it
have to? Well, sure, it feeds itself.
Yeah, with the belt or a clip?
No, it. You see, a brand gun is just you put it in. Now it's so long since I have yeah, you got me now,
yeah.
Because it would take me a little memory, you know.
Yeah.
But there is a barrel, and it's like a clip. Must be like a gun, and you clip it on and. Well, this will go 100 rounds. But you can only go 50 because it heats up. Well, of course, then we had these mortars. They were, we went up there lots of nights and we had 50 mortars, but we had no ammunition there. The next night, different points. You see,
within a different point from where the
yeah, they had this Charlie, they had these code names, and it was only one truck or so. I went through one night. I went through this Happy Valley, and there was Kelso. There was all our boys got lost here around the 19th that night. It was a big fire and all right. And this guy, I forget whether it was McLennan. Well, I never remember sitting in that truck. He went about 90 miles an hour in there because there was no way of getting out of there. And we were trying to get to these guys, which was hopeless. They were outnumbered, you see.
Where would they be, down by the harbor?
No, right in here in Happy Valley.
In Happy Valley, eh?
Yeah, I remember this so well, Happy Valley, you know. Yeah, I remember that. And then we had a rear guard up to Juan. See, I never got much out there. I was more or less in this. I wasn't even on the firing lines here. You see, they had groups that they sent out. And all my job was to consecrate. You see, what it amounted to up to land on Christmas Day, I don't know how it saved us, but this is what, to bring this to a conclusion, this part. We left this, McNaughton was with me, Jimmy Garfield, and we seen our quarter bloke, and he was down, and Paddy Keenan came along, and he says, it's going to be quiet, this was Christmas Day, no. Everything's going to be nice, no firing. So we seen our quartermaster. This is at 6 o'clock in the morning. This is Christmas morning. And he says, where the hell are you guys been? I've been looking for yous and looking for you. He says, I couldn't. So McNaughton says, we were on duty and we weren't. He says, well, forget about that place. He says, I want you to go on road guard. He saved our lives. So we had our dinner there, breakfast there. So this Frenchie.
What kind of stuff would you be eating for breakfast?
Oh, we were eating good then. This was before the war ended.
We get enough to eat?
Oh, yeah, we had our own rations. We were just living like an ordinary army, you know. Oh, yeah, well, hell, the stores and everything that was open there, you could help yourself. So you never wanted to go hungry before that. But anyway, when this Christmas day, I remember so well, we had the Indians was up on the garden, you know what I mean, and the planes were coming over, and so it was about 10 of us was all in these roadblocks, and we were trying to get the boys around. So there was a big, this hospital, now I've heard a lot of talk from it, but on TV and different things, which I've kind of gathered in my own mind. But see, we had, so we got out of this mess, and the but I'm talking about Christmas Day. This happened on the 19th. This is Christmas Day.
Okay, Christmas Day. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
How did you know when you explained it?
Oh, I'll tell you that good. Right. So, we happened to get off this road. So we happened to be passing our place where we were now. Nothing left, blown to hell. That school was all gone.
Did it have ammunition in it?
Eh? It was just an ordinary.
So it must have been bombed or shot.
Yeah, the Japs had spotted somebody. And so we moved into these. Now, all of these officers and stuff that was when it was going to this hospital. Now, I don't think it was Bone Road Hospital or. It was one of these hospitals, Annie, where this priest was, our minister. I think it was a priest, I'm near sure. But anyway, we were swaggering around, all around this up to noon. And there were even, where the Indians were camouflaging, the guns and all, the planes was getting around, bombing every place. So the sergeant said to us, there was about 18 of us, I'm not sure. So we all signed our name, we're going up to this hospital to surrender because there was no other way out. We had lost contact with everybody, you see? So as a group, so we went in there. McNaughton. And he went up. And he says, the guy says, you have to give up your rifles. Well, we said, no, sir, we're not giving up no rifles. We are keeping our rifles to the last minute. Soldier never. So anyway, we said, we haven't eaten all day. Could we get a cup of coffee? He says, now, at the back was an old school ground. And in there was this shelves and different places, you know what I mean, the rooms off this. So we all crawled in there, you see, and in the meantime, this was over a hill, which we got through. So we finally waited. Finally we got this tea or whatever it was. It was around 3 o'clock. So this guy says, we better get the hell out of here. You know what I mean? I don't know. They're sleeping. So we crawled out of there. At 5 o'clock that night, we seen the flag surrender, the white flag up. So just as we got out of there, here comes a bomb right over our plane. A bomb right into the spot where we just left. I bet you weren't no further than this building or that, outside that door. Another, you know what I mean? We just did.
Just left it.
Just left it, and we got right over. And I says to this guy, I said, there's a white flag. He says, that's the surrender party to hell with it. Let us. So he came over in a big, large speaker. Japanese troops, you know. And and the old planes were dipping and diving, you know, that everybody leave down their arms. Don't move. Stay where you are. Do this, do that. And of course we were in there.
Now, where would the speakers be? Would they be in this?
It must be around this hospital, wherever that is. Now, I don't...
Was there anybody in the place where you just left, where the bomb blew it up? You said that you'd just gotten out. Was there anyone else?
Yeah, well, I don't think so. I don't think so. But what I heard from my own experience, what I heard on the radio, I don't know, was a lot of soldiers and stuff, when the Japs did come in there... See, we went to this Peak Mansion. Can you find Peak Mansion here?
Peak Mansion? No, yeah. I don't think it's mine.
It's Peak. Now, that's where we all went, was the Peak. But maybe this would be it, no? The Peak. Anyway, we all went there that night. We stayed there all night. And we didn't see none of the boys till some of them the next day. But somebody told me that whenever the Japs really arrived in there, they'd been at them other guys and stuff that was with this priest. And that was the place that we had left. Like, we didn't actually go in there.
Yeah.
We stayed out of there. You see, this Bone Road Hospital there is the place where we all went to afterwards.
Right. You mean where you were the first time?
Well, the water after we surrendered, all water, everything was cut off.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I hadn't a drink of water for over 3 days. And Joe and me just had a little flask. We were near dying of thirst. So they kept us up at this peak. And then we marched over until to Kowloon again. That was a New Year's Day, if I'm not. So... The remnants, if everybody was all over the place till they got them all. Then when we got to Kowloon, the barracks was half shattered. It was no sanitary conditions. There was nothing. There was holes in the wall. Then the Chinese was selling food over the walls at the black market. When the Japanese were this, throwing them over their head and all this stuff.
Throwing them over their head?
And you know, what do you call this? Karatsky or.
Judo?
You know, yeah. Yeah, judo. Oh, yeah, they were. Japanese was throwing the Chinese up in the air just like mice or bees. And so we had, we all started to look.
Can I ask you something about the battle?
Yeah.
Can you remember about how long you functioned as a regiment? From the day war started?
We functioned about 10 days, I think.
As a regiment.
You see, I'll tell you something maybe for your own benefit. Is we were never in. We had the English regiment there. We had the Scotch regiment there. We had the Indians. We had only 18 days of training, which we never had no idea of the country. We had no idea of where the fighting, the hills. We were all trained for a different. The Hong Kong's built more for a bottle, a port, more for ships. It's all in an island, which we were just Well, we were in a daze the whole time we were there. There was no question. I don't think, as far as I'm concerned, that none of them ever got organized as a unit, because it was everybody for themselves. I know that's what happened to me. And I know lots of the guys, I'd see them one day and they'd be gone tomorrow, like the Sergeant Long. I was in the beer parlor there about a month or so, and his son, you see. And this guy happened to know him, and he says, "You know, we're in Hong Kong. You seen my butt?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "You know Sergeant Long?" I said, "Oh, his son." His son, I says, he says, "I'm going to bring him down." But his son never showed up. Well, I don't blame the kid, because he was a personal friend of mine. But you see, that night, whenever I give him the stuff, and he went over this hill like Sergeant Dickey and the whole works. Like his rifles and ammunition. And this is where we had our stores. You know, we didn't have an awful lot. But if there was a certain group going out, they all stopped off here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you go up this way, and you go this way, and another one goes the other. But he went up that hill, he was never seen again. He left either that night or the morning. And I was speaking to Sergeant Dickey, he's dead too now, but he says, I went after Johnny the next day. Could see nothing, it's just gone, just disappeared. But you see, that's the whole thing. It takes, you were in a kind of a daze. And I think, then I realized after I got this hot feet, an agony of war, and then our weight started to go. I went down to near 90, 95 pounds. And I had chronic diarrhea for 4.5 years. Never had what you call a natural. Never had any inclination to go to washrooms, rice and water. And I actually was very. I only worked about 6 days while I was in the Harvey's camp. Well, now that's a different story. When we landed and got organized, we went to this North Point. So we were all in different huts there. The first, we all regrouped.
As two.
Regrouped. So the Japs, they didn't recognize officers at all. The only men, officers, dead right in Hong Kong. So we had this Harvey, and we had this Tugby that they turned out to be, collaborized with the enemy or so forth. So what really happened was, the first bunch in January, 42, was shipped out to Japan. See?
Were you on this?
No, I wasn't on the first group.
You were in North Point?
I was in North Point, and then we were back to Kowloon.
Did you work in North Point?
I didn't actually work in North Point, because it was more or less a camp where you didn't work. It was more rest, but you didn't get no rest.
You
know,
wounded,
I wasn't actually wounded. I was beriberi and malnutrition, and we all started degenerate, and that's where we get all of this DIP and everything that I wrote in the book. Then we had a war. Our worst month in that year was 42, November and December, the following, because the guys were just going off like, you would be lying next door and you wouldn't know the next guy would be gone. They were wheeling them in and wheeling them out, and that was all that was to it. You didn't know which guy was next to you, who you were sleeping beside, or you could care less. So we had what you call an old Jap doctor. He used to come around once in a while. But this took me after I moved in August. And we were on this, I call it a hell ship. There was 300 of us went on this, and it was like if you've seen a boat, an old coal boat in the old country, this is what it amounted to. We were down in the hole for near 17 days. We never got up, only once a day. Were just like horses. They poured water over us, just like cows, sheep, mm-hmm. And we never had no. We had never. We had 50 guys would sleep right on one wall, you know. And then the any stuff we carried, they threw coal and every damn stuff on top of our belongings, which didn't amount to nothing. And then we stayed in this Formosa in one of these hot spots there for about 2 days in there. So we were another 18 or 19 days on that boat. So whenever we got to Osaki, I think, I'm not sure, but we went on, and it wasn't a bad-looking town, but the Japanese, no women could look at us. They, you know, just knocked the women from one side of the street to the other. So we had seen some Americans in this camp. We were in there for about an hour. But the next day, we were on this train for about a day, or maybe a day, maybe a half, a day and a half. So we landed in this camp. So we landed in there. We had about a mile to walk from the railroad or wherever that is off. So we had went in there. And we had 300 Canadians, I think. And it consisted, there was a mine there, or this factory was supposed to be about half a mile from where we were. So the guys, they worked them old coal chutes and so forth in these mines, which I couldn't move. And I finally, I got this diary, and this Harvey, he was always yakking about more men. He was trying to work the morale, but he was with the Japanese all
the
time.
Was he in charge
of the camp? Well, he wasn't in charge, but he took over. We had our own officers in charge, but he anything the Japs wanted to know, they went through him. And him being an ordinary sergeant, and then this Toby, one of our guys, he went along with him too. So they had their own little.
Did you have any personal experiences with either of them?
Oh, well, I didn't. I knew Tokti pretty good, and because I worked with him in the stores, and him being a sergeant major, and me and him. But after what I seen, me and him ceased to be friends altogether, and. To point out the point, when we got into this camp, we only got one Red Cross parcel divided among eight. I'll always remember his calling us that Sunday. We had an old razor blade, with like a piece of butter, a little piece, anything. You divide it right in eight parts. And everybody seen they got eight parts. And all, And then they used to have a fight over this rice, if it was heated or toasted, you know, or burned rice. Whichever camp had the best behavior got so much each night. And then the Japs used to be our mail, which didn't come very often, and they would shout mail, and they would say, okay, go and light all your fires, you know. Well, they had this old stove, you know, like these Quebec heaters. And as soon as you got a nice fire going, they'd douse it with a bucket of water. They'd come along, and there'd be 50 or 60 guys in a hut, and you just imagine all them old socks and everything from a working party. The smell of the place was terrible. It made you really sick before you had. And then we had what you call hot feet. Everybody went through this Agni Ward situation. You couldn't walk. You couldn't do simply nothing. Well, I went to Bone Road, and you'll find it all in the book there. And I was there for about a week or 10 days. And I had one eye was closed, couldn't see out of one eye. The other eye was half closed. I couldn't even walk.
This is Barry.
Barry and everything. And I lay on that boat or to go over there for 4 hours, and I didn't know where I really was. So this English doctor, Scotch doctor, he operated on my eye. I don't know. And this Freddie Murray, he put an ice pack right on my cheek. But he worked this eye, and it took me about 2 months before I could even see out of it. And it was still a blur.
How is it now?
Well, it's not bad. I still get a percentage of pension over it, on it. And then I had to walk all over again. I couldn't even walk from the length of here to there. And my legs was just absolutely... I always had one intention of coming back to Canada, and that was my biggest idea. And I always, we had old, I must remember, old Pop Wharf. And I think he kept 90% of our guys alive.
Huh?
Wharf. Whartn. Now, he used to sit, and I remember from the first night we were ever prisoners, Hong Kong, it was raining like hell. And he says, you see that boat? He said, we'll be out on there inside of maybe 10 days, maybe a week. He had always a perfect idea, and he could. I seen that there was a bunch of us guys, a guy around maybe 25, 30, 35, all just a bunch of them. Pop could sit and tell jokes there all night long. From 8 o'clock in the morning to any time, we talked about stores, Fisher Branch, anything. He could talk about any subject. And we used to romp around there. A guy get tired or sleepy or rice, come back again. Old Papa would, another story, he could go on forever. I think that guy really kept 90% of the guys, their morale, their life, you know. It really give them something to work for, you know.
Did you work when you were in the camp?
No, I didn't really work. I had what you call chronic diarrhea. I was what you call, I looked after cleaning up the shacks and doing the odd little bit. You see, where my trouble was is I couldn't get no cigarettes, or I had a bum. So this Jeff caught me one time. I got a couple of lickings for smoking when I shouldn't, and so forth. And but I was this doctor. He he wasn't a bad doctor we had, but he always, he said, no, I wasn't fit for no working party. One time I did get up twice to go. I was so sick, and I had my cigarettes. They allow you five or so many cigarettes if you're going out in a working party. So before 9 o'clock, if your name struck off, they come and take whichever cigarettes you have. So you have no chance of getting anything. But outside of that, we toughed it right through the whole damn works. Yeah.
Do you remember when the war was over? Did you have any idea?
Yeah, I did. I'll tell you why. See, we were moving around so often. We always had yes me days. You know, Japanese don't recognize Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So, Harry came along with this Ken Johnson, and us was in the same place. And I was in this room. I couldn't even walk, you know. And I used to walk from the lantern. And they said, a big speech, that was the time they know the atomic, that bomb was on the go. And I don't know whether it was sixth feeling or seventh, we felt there was something on, because they slackened right up, you know. And I remember waking up this morning and they said, no work. And they brought the working party in one night. It was on a Wednesday morning. And that went on for near a week, you see. And all of a sudden, the Japanese guards, it was pretty hostile before. So, and the guys that was friendly, you know, we were all allowed to go out there and play volleyball and different sports, which was even unheard of, you know, which, and all of a sudden out of the way, I woke up and this is it. We think it's all over. And the comment and all, 3 days ahead of that, and Harvey, they all beat it out of camp.
The comment
and? Yeah, the whole works. They just left. They left the guards, you know, but they only had wooden rifles. They didn't have no rifles at all. So it was taken over by our British commander.
Did you say Harvey left too?
Oh yeah, Harvey and Tugby, they beat it. But they caught up to them in the Philippines. They near killed Harvey and them in the Philippines. They caught up to them, you see. Oh yeah, they took off, sure. 3 days ahead of time. So what they done was they brought in a big truck in the morning. Well, the guys, the Americans, was bringing in the stuff, you know, in parachutes. And here one guy says he was down like this, and the Americans brought it down, he shut, you know, away the stuff came down and a bang. And it, yeah, so Harvey and them, whenever they got away out of it, they caught up to them. But Tugby was, you see, whenever I got out, I was taken to a plane, couldn't walk, and the doctor examined it all. So I was taken to, it wasn't Tokyo, it was this Yakomami, or this big, yeah. And we had all our stuff was disinfected. Well, they threw all our stuff junk away. So I was disinfecting about 100 times going through these different places. So the real time I seen, we land in here and I go through, just like going through a department store, that all clean underwear, that all clean shirts, that all pants, that everything you could think of. So we got DS, fact, disinfectant, we all cleaned, and there was a big boat there. And I remember the Yankees saying, California, here I come, you know. And we really felt good, you know. And so in this, I went on this boat for 3 days. 3 days. And this doctor, he says, oh, he gave me this stuff. It was in a bottle every 3 hours. He says, that will put a new line in your stomach. And I said, okay. So I started to eat better, feel better. And he says, okay. He says, so there was 50, there was only me and two other guys. So we were on this stretcher, it was supposed to be 56, one of these 40, you know, these planes, you know. So they lift us up, so we're on our way home. And I got up, something went wrong with the plane, back I come again, not again. So this time we really made the trip. So we had Johnson, Niwanes, Honolulu, stayed overnight there, and they were very... And then when I got back into California or in San Francisco, I was surprised. I was the only... They had, what you call this, police there. Guard, you know, for the plane. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't let nobody near the planes. We were taken off on a stretcher. And they had this police like a cord, you know, an army, the police in front. So they shipped us right into these hospitals, American hospitals. We stayed in two, one night here, one night there. And finally this doctor says, okay. So I went into this place, and I said to this young guy, he was in the army, and he says, where are you from? I said, I'm from Winnipeg. He said, where is Winnipeg? I said, very north. He says, is that where the Markies are? I said, right. I said, very cold. He says, yeah. I says, yeah, very, very cold. He says, you need warm clothes. I says, yeah. He says, give them two suits of everything. And he says, this is American Army stuff. He says, this is the captain, he'll see to you. Oh, he says to the captain, he says, so I got two suits in this American uniform. Four.
Good uniform?
Oh, the best. Nothing but the four lovely shirts, underwear, two pair of shoes, Oxfords, socks. And in fact, I got one of these Army sailor kit bags. So we put all the stuff in there. Oh, I says, thank you, thank you. Says, anytime you're out in Canada, come and see us. Too cold, but I'll come. So we stayed that night, and then we went. Next morning, we got a bus. It was about, that was the best morning in my life. I met about 60 of our guys that, from all over. So we're on our way to Vancouver, see? And now we cut all this red tape. See, lots of them was taking $100 here, $100 there, and they're figuring the Americans was giving them this free. I told this Jack, I said, "Jack, don't be crazy." I said, "Take $50 or whatever you feel, but no more." Oh, guys, big watches, they were taking everything you could. I says, they were all ducked at Ottawa, all that money, you know. But anyway, I took $50. I figured that would get me to Canada anyway. And I said to this, so we got on this train.
Did you have to pay for a ticket?
No tickets, no. But the guys was grabbing everything, you know. It was so comical, you see. So we get to Portland, and we get there on a Sunday afternoon. I remember it so well, you know. And this John White's place, and they have a big dining room there with lots of cigarettes. Lots of chocolates and lots of coffee, bread. Well, the guys, they just went nuts, you know. And I says to this girl, I says, "Where is there any bars around here, you know, for a drink?" She says, "You're not allowed no drink." I says, "I know, but I says, under the cute," she says, "well, there's two taverns." And she says, "What time is your train going out?" Well, I says, "I think 6-7 o'clock, as far as the orders, you know." Then she says, 4 o'clock or so on there. She says, "Well," she says, "upstairs, second floor, is the library where you can write. And then they have a third floor is for dancing or entertainment." And she says, "If you want, you can tell your friends, go up and write. But you don't have to write. There's a back stairway down. You go out through your little door and you're right at the tavern. But," she says, "come back in that way and come down the same way." So anyway, I was dressed up in all this American stuff. Some other guys was dressed up like Sinbad the Sailor and so forth. So we walked into this tavern, you know, about five of this American looks at us and says, "What art fit on you ones?" I said, we're Canadians. "Damn liar," he said, "what are you using that our uniform for if you're Canadian?" "Oh," he says, "yeah." Well, I said, "oh, we're from Hong Kong. We didn't have no clothes, so we had to borrow yours, you know." He says, "what do you want?" "Oh, we want a drink." He says, "on the horse," he says. "What are you drinking?" And we says, "oh, well, anything we can get." "Oh," so we all had a beer. He says, "okay." He says, "bring it around." No, I says, "well, you know, we got to get this train." "We couldn't buy nothing." "Anytime you're back around again, call, boys. We went out there and we weren't feeling any pain, I'm telling you. But we got up there at 6:30, you know, and we came all walking downstairs and we all formed fours and we got into the train, so away we went. So we landed in Little Mountain the next morning. And
is this the border? Or is this?
Yeah, that's, it's just, it's not very far from Vancouver, you see. So we landed in Shaughnessy Hospital there, but the Little Mountain was our camp. So that was, whenever I landed, I went up to about 175 pound there. I just blew up like a, I must bring down the pictures and show you.
Can I ask how you were treated once you got to Canada?
Oh, good, 100%. Oh,
the same as you were in the United States?
Well, you know, we weren't in any ship nor farm to be. I was, you were asked such many questions, which you had lost all feelings, you know. It's a hard thing. You just want one thing, is to get home. And you didn't want to have nothing to do with nobody. You didn't want to talk. You only had one ambition, and you still figured anything you left it, you were either gonna, you didn't know where you were gonna get away, where it was. You didn't know where you were gonna get away with, where it was free. You were scared to do anything. So, I had a month in Vancouver, but I had a friend sent a telegram to a wife, Winnipeg, and she had an old friend in Vancouver, which knew her years ago, which helped me out quite a bit. She used to come and visit me in the hospital.
Did you find that people's attitudes had changed much from before the war?
No.
After the war?
No, I didn't, you see, person figure, look at the job, they figure, well, I want to kill them. Well, I never had that feeling. I know some of the guys did, but I was talking to a guy later on, he said, well, you know, after all, he says, they're born just the same as us. Some of these people born in Canada had nothing to do with this war. So why take it out on them, or why, you know? I didn't hold no grudge, no. I still had the feeling there that I had to go through with it. But I had always the idea, the less you talk about these things, the better. And I never got involved. I listened to guys at beer parlors, different places talking. Never got involved with it. Until one day I was sitting in the Clarent and I was listening to this guy, and he was so hot in Hong Kong. What he done? No, he never was in the war. He never was in the war. We might have been in some other where, but I was old friends was sitting around there and listen. I said to my friend, "Do you know him?" He said, "No, I never knew him." Buying him beer, and I said to him, "But you were in the Grenadiers." He says, "Yeah." He said, "What's your damn business?" I said, "None of my business." I says, "Can you tell me your regimental number?" Says, "Nothing got to do with you. It's none of your damn business." I says, "Not only that," I said, "can you give me the first letter in the alphabet?" And he says, "No, I don't know." Well, I says, "It's time you got the hell out of here." I says, "I happen to be there. And I don't like you talking about stuff you never seen. You know?" So outside of that, I'm neutral, you know? But we finished up on, it took me about a month or 6 weeks before I was in Brampton after I got out of there. I went up to 170 in the mall. I'd buried Barry and had cramps. I suffered for about 6 months or a year after with cramps. And it was, very bad. And then I got down into Brampton for over a month before I finally got home, you know. They were checking up for TB, everything. And then whenever I got back into Winnipeg, I went on to Deer Lodge. And I found it was our doctor, and he was trying to pass it off. So I said, I'm not fit for work. But we finally got a guy from Ottawa for Hong Kong vets only. And you see why I went under each hospital treatment, and I got around $165, $168 a month, but I didn't collect no hourly. See, we got our $1,300 back pay, and then we got our rehab. But I didn't collect none of that money until after he looked after us for 6 months. We only had a report every month until we got our bearings. And that's our, I got into Eaton's, you see. I got into Eaton's and I took it easy. They told me I was no use for any heavy work and couldn't take any heavy.
Do you think you've been treated fairly by the Canadian government? Do you think you could have gotten more for?
No, not exactly. I got 50% right off. Pension. No.
How about what some of the other people didn't?
Well, it was her own damn fault. You see, now you were mentioning Bardell. Funny thing, me and him sat in Deer Lodge for months together. And you happened to show me
his guitar.
You know what Bardell, and I know him well, and he says, Patty, we were 4.5 years behind the fence. We can still stick another 6 months. And I know these guys not mentioned. Yes, when we came up in the Deer Lodge, their names was called dozens of times, which never showed up. They had these cars. They had this money. And they weren't interested in pensions. They weren't interested in nothing. They're only interested is to get out. They didn't. Oh, and they finally lined up with about 10 or 15%, you know. Some of them with none. Now, about 3 or 4 years, they said to me, "How did you get 50% right off?" I said, "No, I used to go up and sit. I said at Deer Lodge from 9 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon, and not even see a doctor for weeks. But I still went there." My name was, that was all on my record. Whenever I went down to the commercial building, that doctor told me, Cook or whoever, give me, he says, you're only half a man, you're entitled to half of this pension that's coming to you. And we have taken into consideration everything you've gone through, your health, and your age, and we figure half of your life was lost, half of your life over there, or the best part of it. So we figure you should get your 50%, which I was able to work, and I haven't stopped a day from I left, because I figure out once you stop active, you cease to exist. Not a whether, you know the old story you've heard in the army, and I got it so much drilled into me from the First World War, I said I never, the government owes me a living. I don't want to do any damn thing. I want them to feed me. I want them to look after me.
You were in the First World War?
No. No, but I heard that so much. From the old vets from the First World War. I said, no, I wouldn't. I made up my mind on that score. I wasn't in that lineup. You know what I mean? There's a lot of guys, you know, that's gone through the army, and they figure the army owns them a living. They don't want to work, or if they do work, well, it's against their principle. You know? So, how goes the time?
Okay. Is there anything else you would like to talk about? I don't think I have any more questions. Anything you'd like to talk about what happened in the camp? Any amusing stories or funny things?
Oh, Oh, yeah, we had our entertainment, like McKinnon there put all the shows on for us. Archie McKinnon put all the shows on. And he had these pair of, what do you call them, personating women. And the fellow, man, and they looked real good. I enjoyed everything. And when the Red Cross parcels came in, was a kind of a setback. Like we got only half of one or half of the other. But it's...
Is that because only a few came?
Yeah, well, for the first time we only got one between eight, and then we got one between two. But it's very funny that a person, you can live with them, talk to them, and yet whenever you have to, if they figure you're getting a little more than you, there's something in their system revolts again, you know, which I know guys stole of me, you know. Even I was a prisoner of war, mm-hmm. which I don't think it's right, you know. But they thought they were getting away with something, you know. And so you have these persons, no matter where you go, you know. Even some Americans, especially in the Mexico, we had a few there was rotten, dirty, no sanitary, steal your underwear. I used to have to go into a bath, hold a soap, keep my underwear on the one hand, and then in the bath, out goes your Mr. Harvey would proceed at 4 o'clock. And we had to work 4 days with wood, you know, and we had to fill that tub with the old siphon, you know. And
where was the water siphon?
No, I see the water
yeah.
in the camp. And it was like one of them old, you see, to fill, say this room here,
yeah.
right up to here. Well, to fill this tank, they had a big pump. But you had to pump the water in.
Oh, yeah. By hand?
By hand,
yeah.
right. So we had our 4 hours of that every other day, you know, 2 hours. But whenever they heated that water, Mr. Harvey and his henchmen went in first for their showers every Thursday or whatever day it was. So, and as soon as the 5 o'clock gang came in from the camps, the working parties, they all went in.
Mm-hmm.
So us poor victims of circumstance that couldn't never work but had to do a little chores around, we got in. And the damn place was so black, where the water was so dirty. Right. Right. And soap was like you had to take a keg of soap, it was like $100. You had to keep it in your hand all the time, or they'd steal anything they could get their hands on, you know.
What were the other men doing? What
were
they working?
Well, they worked at a mine. I had one experience. I went out this January the 1st, and this Mike, you know, he's down in California. But this was this big mine, and we went on this train journey. And I got a little pair of these gloves, which cotton, and one of these little jackets, and we were picketing this mountain at the side, you know. And I don't know to this day, this big Jap or somebody was up on top. And you know, Meg and me was, for all that, we can hardly lift the pick, let alone chop. So, here, I says to Mike, I says, look up at this guy. And we walked out. Here half of the stuff came right down. It covered over our little coats, covered over our pickets, and our gloves, you couldn't even see them. And what a day that was. And then they give you supposed to be a big meal, you know. At the time you get there, there's nothing left because this guy takes his, another guy takes. Then they've one big fire, you know, and nobody can get at it. And you went out at 7, or you left camp about 7, you got there about 9 o'clock, and you worked for 2 or 3 hours, and you had lunch at 1 o'clock, and then you had another, and you had to walk about 3 miles to the train, and your feet was like that, and then you had to walk 2 miles back from the camp, from the train. The time you got there, you were so tired, you didn't. I had one day of it, but that was it. You couldn't. And then they had what you call these guys, they used to put on these extra parties, not parties, but extra rations. And I'd had these trucks, and I'd say, well, if you make 6 more trips or so, we'll give you this extra rice. You remember, volunteers, some of the guys used to work till they were dropping off their feet, you know, just to get that extra. But the meal, I don't think was any good for them, to be honest with you. But outside of that, I take the good along with the bad. I never remember. I had one idea. I'm getting out of here. And I made up my mind from the day I walked in there to the day I walked out. Never regret it. I don't hold no spite, nothing, you know. Mm-hmm. Take it as it comes. It's the same when anything else that goes. So I think I told you pretty well near everything I remember up to. right now, you know. You see some funny things, you know, which maybe some people don't think much of, but means a lot later on, you know. And but I think out of our old gang, I never met better guys to soldier with and to work with. Even after we came back, we have our conventions. We never look at the bad. We always seem to look at the good side. We always seem to be building up for new, better, you know. We never look... If you take everybody that I know, I never heard one guy even complaining or, you know, he figures, well, it's all over, let us be happy. Why talk about it, you know? So that's the way I feel. Whenever I came back, a reporter says, oh, I want to... I said, no, not in your life. See, we had a trial there, Harvey and them, and I went 1 half more and I wouldn't go back. What good does a man know after 3 months, 3 years? What can he tell? All he's looking is for a meal. 3 months, he would have forgot everything. That's what I told him, one guy. I said, that's only a farce. See, they got 9 months of suspended sentence or something, so what did it matter? You know, and I always maintain, if you can't do anything good, don't do anything bad. But that doesn't always work out the way it should be. But these guys, they figure they got their desserts. whether we're traitors or what they were. The guys who didn't go over, and I have nothing against them. I just treat them like an ordinary.
These are the guys that jumped off the
train. I have nothing against them. No, I'm just talking. But still, they have their feelings too. And after all, I figure, well, it's easier to live the way you should than to live the other way. Because no matter what you do, you can never replace it. And you can never say, well, whether you like the country or whether you don't. It's the same way all over.
How do you feel about the Japanese?
Nothing. I came from a kind of a little radical country. I was born, and I've seen all Irish and fighting and disputes. And I came to one conclusion: if you're a prisoner, you're a prisoner. You're no good of trying to fight against something you can't win, and you just take whatever comes. The more you try to, as I told a guy, and he was always cursing and swearing, and jobs this, jobs that. I says, it's not the, it's not the people. I says, well, you might be in the same soup someday yourself, or some of your friends, but you have to live with these people. You can't condemn them, because some of these people has nothing whatsoever to do with this. They never started it. They just happened to be in there. We met guys with Japs. I met a big Mongolian one night, and I'd done a double duty for this guy. He gave me a couple of cigarettes extra one night. So I was sitting out there in the cold night too, you know. So he came along, he says, hello, Canadian. Oh, in English. And he was a big Mongolian or something. And he says, pretty cold, eh? Yeah. He said, what time is it? 2 o'clock. Say, how long have you been here? I said, another hour. He says, don't bother going outside. He says, sit where you are. He says, I'm on guard duty till 4 o'clock. You stay where you are. Good night. There you are. See, we had a report about 45. Then we you have to count any guy going out to the washroom or something, they find out one guy not there. They bing you right over the head with the old rifle butt, you know. Where's the man? So you have to watch everything you do. So I'd say to them guys, boy, they weren't bad at all. I liked some of them that you never got really talking to them, you know. Some of them we were talking to these. What I detested was these interpreters that was supposed to be English or supposed to be on your side, and they were none whatsoever. Like, we had these Lagans or something, I don't remember, but I remember standing out there until we were near frozen. And then they always pulled, just as you were going to get your rice at 6 o'clock or 5 minutes to, they'd pull the switch and they'd have everybody outside. And the guys couldn't even keep their water all over them. Stand them out there for 8 and 10 hours at a time. And just because something went wrong. time you come back, your rice was so damn cold you couldn't even eat it. So it was a lost meal, lost, you know what I mean. It was, eh? Sure, sure. Oh, yes. No, it was a rough deal, right enough, you know. Rough deal. Yeah, she sure was. It, I figure the boys that came back and the boys that was left there, I don't think they have anything to regret, you know. They're your friends and everything. So.
Maybe a good place to leave it off.
Hey?
Maybe a good place to
leave it off. Yeah. Good thing, too. Is that all tape in there?
Yeah.
Okay. My friend Joe Koloski, Sergeant Koloski, and me landed in the camp together, and we kept together. Which I got a hold of these books, and I told him I was going to write this diary in case one of us had to leave the camp, we would give it to the other one before we left. And to my collection, I reported everything up to while I was in Hong Kong, when I was in Japan, up till I left for Japan. And
did you keep a record each day?
Yeah.
Pretty well, or every few days or so?
I kept it mostly weekly records, and I made notes different, and I got a list of the boys that went into these different hospitals and was under doctor's care, and I got a list of the ones was in Agni Ward, which was, you generally never came out again. So Joe and me, He was worse off. His eyesight started to go on him, and he told me before. He said, "If any chance of you leaving, give me the diary before you leave." Well, I came from Bone Road at the time. I spent a couple of months there, and I still had all the notes in the diary up to that trip, which when I came back to camp was Percy Williams and a few of the boys. We had what you call a pipeline in this camp. So this morning, out of the blue sky, the Japs came and lined us all up, and they says, all walk across till the other side. Those who can't walk, stay behind. Well, which at the time, when I thought if I couldn't walk, it would be too bad. So I managed to get across. So they said, all the good ones, they got to the other side, they're going to Japan. And the ones who couldn't make it, stayed. So when we were going to Japan, they put us in this war or intersection for 2 weeks. And they give us all kinds of these shots in the arm, the behind, and so forth. At that time, I figured it was a good time to leave my diary and everything, what I had, was Joe. So I said to Joe, in case I don't see you, I says, here's what I have. He says, I'll look after it. So in the meantime, I had forgotten all about the dairy at the time till I came back home. And I met Joe. Well, Joe was pretty well blind. And our first reunion was, after we came back, was at the auditorium. And Joe didn't recognize much. He could see very, but he knew my voice. So anyway, he was living up off Selkirk Avenue of McPhillips. He was married, and his wife and him and her mother lived up. So I used to visit them up in that facility, and Joe talked. He must have had this old case or trunk, which he put all his army stuff in. And I guess his wife, seeing that it was personal, she never wanted to open it, which left me and Joe. We were talking about things in general. So the last time I really seen Joe was at the on Selkirk, where there was this dance, and we all got, my wife and my friends and all was there. And always remember Joe, he couldn't see. So he heard my voice. He says, is that you, Pat? He says, right. So I came over and I talked to him for most of that night. That was the last time I really talked to him. Right up to then, I had forgotten all about Darius. I never even remembered anything whatsoever.
So the diary was kept pretty well up until the point you left Japan.
Yeah.
To go to Japan.
Yeah. And then I went after my wife died in June. It was a shock and everything. I get this letter in the mail with this. And whenever I opened it, it was I couldn't remember it till it came back to me that I must have written it, because it's all down there in black and white. And so I'm pretty well sure that Joe must have kept everything what was in there.
Well, he continued it on afterwards?
No, he never...
He never continued. He just hung on the campus for you, right?
Yeah, well, he never left Hong Kong, you see.
Yeah.
And I guess he had this trunk when he got home, and all his personal stuff, until his wife started to clean out. He'd maybe been dead for over 10, 15 years, so his wife has opened this trunk, and here all of a sudden she discovers it. And that must have been from since 1944, 45, up to 71. That must be 25, 26 years. So it must have been lying there for a long time. So I think that should cover the dairy part,
sure.
Eh?
Yeah, sure. Now, most of what you put in the diary was what you personally picked up in the camp.
Oh,
the
yeah.
Information that you received from other people, what you saw.
Oh, yeah. I must have got all of that, because I figure I must have taken it pretty near every couple of days, because the guys were going so fast.
Right.
And to get all their names and numbers, you had to be right on the job, you know. It couldn't, like if I'd have left it over a 6 month period, I'd have never got it. You know what I mean? You I have their guys write up with their disease, what they died of, and everything. So it must have been kept pretty well up to the mark, you know. And I, like Percy Williams and a few of us, got reading books. Like I read three books, Scotland and Ireland and all of these, on history, which I never realized I would never read in my life before, but it just shows you how much you can even learn in a prison camp, you know, because after all, you get these stories, and remember it was 17th of March, and old William says, Percy says to me, there's a couple of good books down there, In Search of Ireland. I says, who's in search of Ireland and here? He says, well, maybe you could find out something. By God, it was the best book I ever read. Sure. Then I read two or three in Scotland at a pretty good library there, you know. But outside of that, not bad, you know. But and that's all about the dairy I can think of right up to... I must have read it or kept it pretty well up to, because after all, been in Bone Road and everything up and keeping it from the Japs, because they searched everything, you know. So Joan must have had it pretty good, you know. Whenever you take everything in consideration, and of course he did. I never directly seen him till I got back, and then it was only through social calls, you know, that. He died about 3 or 4 years after we got back. So I think that's pretty good, eh?
Yeah.